Hello, welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Here we are having one of our many strolls that we have. We've just had a yoga weekend where we have been discussing with the students the idea of the meaning to life and is there a meaning to life. And I was in the kitchen burning the dinner when they were having this talk. So Pete recorded it and I've just been listening to it this morning. And just raised a lot of interesting questions for me. There's a lot of interesting ideas in there. So we've been having this conversation over breakfast about a different, slightly different aspect of what they were talking about at the yoga weekend. And I sort of opened our conversation this morning saying, well, to be honest, for me personally, I am completely happy with there being no meaning to life, life being completely pointless, and I'm very comfortable with that. And not only am I'm not just comfortable with life being pointless, but I actually feel liberated by that. And I feel to be unconstrained by a meaning and unbound and untethered by an imposed meaning, either by an external things imposing a meaning upon me or doing it to myself, to be free from that is actually a really great thing. And I know sometimes people can feel quite depressed about, oh, and there's that line, isn't there? And I have felt it myself on occasion in the past. Oh, life is pointless. Yeah. It feels very meaningless. So that can be a horrible thing.
Yeah.
But I've just had moments of that in my life, but most of the time I do feel it as it's pretty wonderful and actually very relaxing. And you know, when I'm dead, if nobody even remembers my name, I'm really not bothered either. You know, I'm quite happy with that. So we started off talking about that. So then that led on to, well, if I can be comfortable with that and actually see it as a liberation and something which is, it really frees me to explore myself and my own creativity and my own life and my potential, then why can't other people do that too? Mm-hmm. What's going on with this grasping for meaning, which seems to be so causes people a lot of anguish and pain? So that's where we began.
Well, I think you're perfectly right that meaninglessness, a sense of meaninglessness, is very painful to a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean, you're living proof, not everybody. And I did, in fact, the other day, have a conversation with somebody, and I didn't initiate the conversation, but the guy I was talking to said he was bemoaning how our culture couldn't really provide people with meaning. And that was quite painful and depressing.
Yeah.
And my reply was, well, as far as I'm concerned, life is completely meaningless, completely pointless, and that is exhilarating.
Yeah.
You know, which kind of surprised the guy. His eyes kind of shot open wide. You know.
Yeah. Thought,
maybe. Yeah. You know. I mean, what I was doing there was mischievously suggesting another line of inquiry.
Yeah.
Instead of just being jerked around by that feeling of hopelessness and meaninglessness, and actually having a look if we can get underneath it or behind it or around it in some way. But we shouldn't, having said that, we shouldn't. We shouldn't underestimate it, its power. And I don't think we'd have had thousands of years of the established religions in the world if there wasn't a mighty appetite for some kind of tidy sense of meaningfulness.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't underestimate the pain that is caused by meaninglessness and the appetite of humans for meaning.
That's the thing I'm interested in. It's appetite there so strongly?
Well, I don't know whether that's a question you can answer except by speculating, to be honest. But as for how it works, I would draw your attention to the case of Leo Tolstoy, which I also have talked about in the talk.
Yeah.
But he wrote a short book or a short Tanya mentioned to an essay, really. I forget the title. It's called something, I don't know, My Faith or My Life or something. I just honestly don't remember the title.
Yeah.
But towards the end of his life, Tolstoy famously took a turn away from his artistic self, away from being the greatest Russian novelist. And as an artist of absolutely the highest calibre. And he's turned his back on that and started writing religious tracts.
Yeah.
And seemed to be sort of kind of guilt-ridden in his old age and wanted to be a saint or something like that. But this is all laid out, obviously with great literary skill, in this paper I'm referring to. He relates finding life meaningless.
Yeah.
And so he embarked on a programme of study to try and find the meaning, and he studied maths and logic and so on. And he thought, well, like Wittgenstein,
yeah,
he thought that maths and logic could only arrive at tautologies. The truths in maths and logic are tautologies.
You're passing a herd of children in a minute.
And a tautology is a statement like naught equals naught.
Yeah.
It just says the same thing twice. It doesn't add anything to knowledge. It just it just says the same things twice. It equates two statements which are actually exact, which say the same thing. So it's not advancing us into any new propositions.
No. So logic really wasn't getting him anywhere in
maths and logic and various other studies. And he concluded that all he could do was take a leap of faith or commit suicide.
That's really sad.
Or commit suicide. And he came very, very close to suicide. And at the last moment jumped into the arms of Mother Russia. And just became, which was the conservative established church of the society which he lived in. And he just leapt into the arms lock, stock and barrel. And that was the only way. Now what was going on there? I would say that what is going on there, that what Tolstoy bought into, that comforted him in the face of this immensity of meaninglessness, was theology, or sometimes we call it ontotheology, or what postmodern philosophers like Lyotard would call grand narratives. And what this does is, what ontotheology or grand narrative does is it answers all the big questions all at the same time and arranges these questions into a system.
As you said, nice and tidy.
Nice and tidy. Yeah. And the appeal of it is its tidiness.
Yeah.
Freud said of religion, religious belief, but it had an enviable completeness.
Yeah.
And that is very, very attractive.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's very attractive.
Well, not personally to me, but I see how it could be to
But we know historically
that it's
very attractive.
Yeah.
And somebody, an artistic genius of the calibre of Tolstoy, still fell for it.
Yeah.
So, just repeat it here, we don't underestimate this stuff.
Yeah.
It's
very seductive.
People are quite prepared to slaughter whole swathes of other people in the name of a grand narrative.
Yeah.
Because those other people don't subscribe to the same grand narrative.
Yeah.
What a grand narrative does is to say it explains everything all at once.
Yeah.
So it tells you, let's just think of some kind of crude version of Christianity just to make it easy. But bearing in mind, this applies bloody everywhere.
Yeah.
Whenever you get these kind of shared belief systems that control and organise a society. Now, in the case of Christianity, you know what you're supposed to do morally, because God told you via the revelation through Moses and Jesus, the Ten Commandments: don't steal, don't murder, don't tell lies, etc. The whole morality is justified because God told us what it is we're supposed to do.
Yeah.
He tells us what our duty is. But also, you know, big anxiety for human beings is death. Where do we go? Where do we go? When we die, do we go anywhere?
Yeah.
Very anxious. Well, this can be answered in exactly the same way, by reference to God, by reference to the system, to the story. Yeah? And the story is, well, God in his goodness deemed it that the good will go to heaven, the mediocre will go to purgatory where they'll do their jail time and then go to heaven, and the really, really crap will be burned in everlasting torment and fire at the hands of the great fallen archangel Satan in hell.
Yeah, nice and tidy again there. Three-tier system.
Where do we come from? Well, we're children of the world. God created us, Adam and Eve, in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
So, you got, where do we go in? Where do you come from? What are we supposed to do? It says, what kind of things exist? What exists? Well, the heaven and the earth. It says so in the Bible, which is God's word. Mm-hmm. So everything is explained. Every big question, every kind of gnawing conundrum that presents itself to you and makes you uncomfortable, because you want to know. You need to know. You want to be able to orientate yourself in life. You want to belong to a society where everybody shares the same values.
Yeah.
You know, and of course it says, what do we value? Is also in there. It might be family, you know, or state, or the priesthood. Sorry. But these systems always tell you what to value as well.
Yeah.
So they actually operate by getting a community to share the same story. They're all watching the same soap opera.
Yeah.
With rapt attention.
Yeah.
If you like, if you could put it like that.
Yeah.
And that fulfills a function for a society of enabling it to hang together, to cohere. But all the questions are answered with reference to God. And I call this a central signifier, or a central transcendental concept, or something like that.
Yeah.
If you think about these kind of structures, they kind of, everything refers to the centre, and they're actually hierarchical, because the centre is also the top of a hierarchy. You know, the most important thing in the universe is God. So he sits at the top of the hierarchy of value.
Yeah.
Second most important thing is the angel. Third most important thing is the humans. Fourth most important thing is the dogs and the cats. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you have this hierarchy of value as well. And it does do this job for people.
So because it's so complete and so tidy, it's almost like we have the meaning now, we can relax and
that's
carry
it.
On with
we
things.
We can go back to fucking sleep.
Yeah, we can go you back know. To sleep,
so,
yeah.
And of course how it works is that not only do we have an appetite for this stuff, which is why this is the game humans have been playing for thousands of years, mostly.
Yeah.
Most everywhere. There's a few exceptions and there are people who rebel against it, but basically the human story is the story of following and acting out these grand narratives and having our societies organised by them in a hierarchical fashion. Now it's interesting that you know, a hierarchical ontotheology or metaphysics or grand narrative, strangely enough, serves, this is kind of society it serves the best, the hierarchical societies.
Yeah.
You know, we've got the king at the top.
That's funny though, isn't it?
Yes. Nothing suspicious there.
Yeah.
But King Charles I, you know, did all sorts of things, ordered all kinds of wars and taxes and all that. People would say, well, how can you do that? He'd say, well, I'm the king, and kings are appointed by God.
Yeah.
So, see how it transcribes across from social structure to conceptual hierarchical structure and back again. But the other thing about this is that not only do people have an appetite for it, and they'll prefer tidiness to chaos, to conceptual chaos. They want to know where they are and what they're supposed to do, rather than be adrift in a sea of meaninglessness. You know, Tolstoy couldn't tolerate it. You know?
Yeah.
But the other thing they do, of course, is the other way it operates, the other thing that the human animals do is that they educate the young to be prone to this kind of stuff. You have it drummed into you as well. Not only do you have an appetite for it in some kind of raw basic form, but you have it drummed into you with the particulars as well.
Mm.
Why is it a problem that people have lived inside grand narratives for thousands of years? I mean, after all, it's enabled social living, which is brought about all kinds of goods, hasn't it?
Yeah. which might be the reason why the human race survived, really, I suppose.
It might even be down to that, and certainly the fact that we live twice as long as our great-grandparents and so on, and enjoy better health. And
yeah, so there's been a time when it's been many useful more. And possibly necessary.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you can't kind of knock social organisation, even though some of it's not very nice.
Yeah.
But you know,
like human sacrifice and things.
Human sacrifice, slavery, etc.
Yeah.
It nevertheless isn't going to go away, I would say. Well, I'd say it's a problem. But existentially, for the reason that you gave in your opening preamble, when you said, well, you don't need it, and you feel free and unconstrained.
Yeah.
You're dancing, I call this dancing under the open sky.
Yeah, and I just like to point out there that even though I feel like I'm quite happy with the meaninglessness of life and it being pointless, I'm still have a lot of passion and are very creative as well.
Yeah.
So it doesn't. I don't just like sit in an armchair all day because life is pointless. Why bother doing anything?
Yeah,
that's not my
way
of being.
It's not a kind of. It's actually not a nihilism.
No.
People who take your approach to living are often accused of nihilism, but I would actually say that it's living in the grand narrative is nihilism.
Yeah.
Because you have to sacrifice quite a lot to do it, particularly your freedom to inquire. Now every grand narrative, when it becomes an institution, like the Catholic Church, for instance, will say that there are boundaries on this narrative. There are questions that you do not ask. You don't ask the awkward questions because the narrative is complete. And in the old days, you know, somebody like Galileo in whenever it was, late 17th century, you know, was put under house arrest for looking through a telescope and asking questions about the planets.
Yeah.
He wasn't supposed to ask questions about the planets because the church told you how the planets moved. Why therefore did you need to actually go and look for yourself? So a whole area of questioning was prescribed. And I would put it to you that the function of religious institutions, one of them, is to proscribe or forbid.
Hello.
It's to proscribe or forbid certain lines of questioning. And when the church had power, it wasn't too bothered about burning people and killing people and torturing people for moving into zones of questioning which were forbidden and which were an insult to the church's claim to absolute authority, itself based on the grand narrative that purportedly answers all the questions. Number one. So that's number one objection to the scenario. It curtails our freedom as individuals and as societies, in fact. And, you know, I get to think, well, how much creativity and talent was wasted because of that?
Yeah.
Terence McKenna tells a funny story about, he imagined there was a twin Earth. At some point, the Earth split into two.
Yeah.
It cloned itself.
Children.
Yeah. 2,000 years ago. But in our scenario, Christ was crucified and out of that whole kind of church story arose and ruled the world on the back of the Roman Empire. But on twin Earth, it didn't happen. Christ wasn't crucified. So Christianity never developed.
Yeah.
And then McKenna likes to tell the story of the history of twin Earth. And he said they had a man on the moon in the 9th century, you know, you know, and they'd got...
Because people are allowed to ask questions.
Yeah, they'd got photovoltaic cells and computers in 1250, you know, because the questioning was uninhibited.
Yeah, I think South Park had an episode very similar to that too, and Family Guy as well.
Yeah, now whether he got it from South Park or South Park got it from him, who knows, you know. So number one problem, freedom and curtailment of freedom and creativity and everything that leads to. This comes when you think you've got all the fucking answers. You've got no need to ask any questions. Second objection is, it's a philosophical objection, and it's to do with the way in which any grand narrative that's going to be the ruling story of a society has to claim for itself that it's absolutely true. Just like King Charles, he was appointed by God. The grand narrative is given by God. It cannot therefore be questioned. It cannot therefore be questioned. It claims an absolute authority. Yeah?
Yeah.
It's transcendentally guaranteed. It's divinely ordained.
Like transcendentally guaranteed. Yeah.
And just getting back to the way this filters down into social organisations, you have this wonderful Victorian hymn that's still much liked. But I don't think they sing this verse anymore. All things bright and beautiful.
Right.
The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate. God made them high and low, each to his own estate.
Mm.
Eh?
Mm, nice.
Matches my point beautifully, doesn't it?
It does rather, yeah.
It's quite a nice tune, really, but pity. What do they, you know? Staying your place, young man.
Yeah.
Don't get ideas above your station.
Of course, so, the woman having no station at all.
And the woman having no station at all.
Lovely.
I mean, wasn't I saying to you over breakfast, you know, I think of those countries where women are not allowed to be educated.
Yeah.
And so they're going to have like 50% fewer doctors, 50% fewer teachers, 50.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Crazy or stupid.
Yeah.
And, well, crazy and stupid.
Yeah.
Anyway, that is a philosophical problem. Is that idea that there's a transcendental guarantee. Now, as philosophers have been talking to each other over the centuries, and philosophy is the conversation across time of humankind.
Yeah.
I love that definition of philosophy now, the conversation of mankind.
Yeah.
So I talk to Plato every day.
Yeah.
I talk to Nietzsche every hour.
Yeah.
I talk to Patanjali every 5 minutes. Yeah. So
yeah.
It's a conversation. And slowly the way that conversation has hedged around over a couple of thousand years is that it's actually really, really, not only difficult, but probably in principle impossible to transcendentally guarantee anything. This is what postmodernism. You know, Jean-Francois Lyotard said, it gets a bad press, postmodernism, but it goes with some intelligent stuff within that corpus. Jean-Francois Lyotard, his formulation was, the postmodern condition, our cultural condition, is marked by suspicion of grand narratives, incredulity towards grand narratives. We know too many other things to buy into this stuff. It's very difficult for people to take the leap of faith these days because we see that it's human, all too human.
Mm.
Which, of course, was Nietzsche's point, you know. And Vico, it's not like people have never known this, but it's just that now it's in the popular consciousness, not evenly around the world at all by any means, but nevertheless, this is an insight that's not going to go away. This stuff is man-made, folks. Its claim to a transcendental guarantee is bullshit. You can't make it hold, no matter how hard you try. You can't put sufficient sticking plasters on it to keep it together.
Yeah.
And that's another problem with it. So, it's all meaningless then, eh? It's all meaningless.
So now that we've outlined the many problems to having this watertight meaning of life and needing a meaning of life.
Yeah.
I personally feel not needing a meaning and creating my own meaning if I want one, which I feel I can, I enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I would like to be able to help people to enjoy that way of being as well.
Yeah. Well, I suppose I'm a bit with the existentialist a little bit on this, with, you know, Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre to some extent, but in thinking, well, the grand narratives and the meanings which the meaning systems which we're offered, which make our lives meaningful, and which save us from the despair of the type that Tolstoy suffered of meaninglessness, they're empty. We've seen through them. anybody with half a brain can see that this is kind of man-made stuff masquerading as transcendental, divine stuff. But therefore, you know, we don't sit in the corner rocking and drooling.
Yeah.
As a result, that your life, it's now for you in your freedom. Because remember, the grand narrative curtailed your freedom.
Yeah.
It told you to stay at your gate.
Yes.
Both in terms of your economic activity and in terms of your thought and your inquiry.
Yeah.
But what you do in this situation, you know, is because it's meaningless. That is what gives us our freedom, our existential, ineluctable existential freedom. It manifests, or it actualizes itself. If one rejects grand narratives, you know, and rejects the temptation to dive into the arms of a fucking comforting story.
Yeah.
But it then says, well, your life becomes meaningful through the projects that you engage with. You decide what you want to do. And even if the circumstances are not great, you go for it. And significance and meaning comes out of that, comes out of our projects.
Yeah.
And this is what stops us from rocking in the corner and dribbling. That we're engaged with life.
Yeah.
With life. And this is what I say, the meaning of life is life.
Yeah.
Live it. But don't live it blindly or unconsciously. And then it is kind of meaningful, strangely enough.
Yeah.
But it's not the kind of meaning that you buy at the expense of your freedom.
Yes. Okay, so it's nice to give some practical help for anybody who might want to.
Somebody rocking in the corner.
Someone
dribbling.
Who's rocking in the corner and perhaps has realised that life is meaningless and is in Tolstoy's position. So
yeah, I'm sure we have friends like that, don't we?
Yeah, maybe we do. Yeah, if we were going back in time and we were in Tolstoy's living room with him and he was having a really bad time and he was crying into his beer.
Yeah.
What would we do to help him? What would we say?
Here, man, have a hit on this.
And then after that...
Yeah, we wouldn't really say that to him. Well, even though, I don't know how sensible that would be. But I had to crack a joke.
Yeah. Sorry.
This is what I'd say to him. Leo, my old pal, what's going on here? Is it that nothing matters? And he says, yeah, nothing matters. Nothing matters. All of my artistic success is as nothing. My family, my children, my estates, my farms, they are as nothing. So, nothing matters then, Leo, nothing matters. That's right, nothing matters. Well, Leo, if nothing matters, it doesn't matter that nothing matters, does it, my dear?
So it doesn't matter that nothing matters.
I would just press him to be a little bit consistent.
Yeah. And do you think that would be enough? Well, what would you think he would?
I don't know.
But after he got over the initial shock of that sentence, what would he retort with?
I see. Yes. Oh.
I'm going to be happy now forever.
I'm going to be happy forever. Of course, you know, he might have a deep endogenous depression. He might have a brain tumour.
Yeah.
Making him pressing on a part of the brain. It's just making him pessimistic. Who knows? You know, who knows?
But
people can't always be talked out of despair, etc. You know, so we know that. But nevertheless, that little statement, which it's redolent of high school clever dickery, but nevertheless, ponder it. It's full of juice.
Yeah.
If nothing matters, then it doesn't matter that nothing matters.
Yeah.
I stole that actually from Thomas Nagel. I also stole Dancing Under the Open Sky from Michael Frey. So, just thought I'd give you our listeners the provenance of some of these terminologies.
Okay, well, I hope that's helpful for anyone who
is rocking in the corner.
Is rocking in the corner and might feel that it would be.
Yeah.
They might enjoy the fact that,
Do some yoga, go for a walk in the woods or by the sea.
Yeah.
Gaze into the eyes of your beloved and all will be well. What more meaning do you want? You are the eyes of the world.
You're the universe being conscious of itself.
Yes, what you are.